This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We have all the time in the world. Time enough for life to unfold. All the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step out the way, we'll find.
Welcome back to part two of our five-part series chronicling the legacy of the James Bond franchise here on the Place to Be Nation pop feed and placetobenation.com. I am your host, Scott Criscolo. We got one down and four to go, but tonight we're going to probably talk about the more unfamiliar Bonds that you may be thinking of. And maybe some, maybe three Bond films that you may not even have seen. We call them the Others, but I cannot do it alone. This fine gentleman joined me for part one, and he'll be joining me for the rest of them. He is the former purveyor of OpenTheFridge.net. He is a Bond expert. He is a Star Wars. He's an expert on all the franchises, and he's making his debut here on the series on the pop feed. Mr. Rob Piontek, a.k.a. Tech. We haven't quite gotten to the Lotus yet, sir, but, I wish I can get you your own Lotus as a thank you for joining me and joining here on the Place to Be feed.
Oh, you're too kind. Thank you for having me back.
We'll talk more about Lotuses in the next episode.
Absolutely.
So of course, Tech and I in episode one talked about Sean Connery because Sean kicks ass, but Sean of course had to leave. So, he left after You Only Live Twice, after doing five fantastic films. He was kind of fed up with the role. He was pissed off at Cubby. He was pissed off at Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli. Left, came back, did a stinker in Diamonds Are Forever, and then we didn't see him again in Bond for 12 years when he decided to stick it to Cubby again by being Bond in the alternate, it's like the alternate jersey, the alternate film for Thunderball, Never Say Never Again in 1983. And then that was it. We never saw him again. And now, in essence, Sean's retired from acting, even though he's done just fantastic movies left and right. As a matter of fact, one of our favorite Sean Connery films, Sir, came out the same year as one of the movies we're talking about tonight. They blew it away, too. Okay. So tonight we're going to talk about the other two actors, besides the big four, that played James Bond throughout the history of the franchise and the three movies that it entailed. Let's go back to the 60s. Again, You Only Live Twice came out in 1967. Tremendous hit. But by this point, Sean Connery was tired of the grind of being Bond, of the, you know, the media and all the traveling. He was thought he was being stiffed, thought he should have been making more money than he was. And he thought it was Cubby and Harry's fault. And so he said when his five-picture deal was up, he was leaving. So they needed a new Bond. Boy, did I not want to be those guys, Tech. Could you imagine that? Like, oh, we need a new Bond? Fuck. Imagine sitting in their office. What would you be thinking?
You're five movies deep with a guy who has left an indelible mark on this role. You know, it's a worldwide phenomenon. You know, England, U.S., you know, you name it. And it's akin to, well, I've since eaten my words since, but back in 07 when somebody announced, oh yeah, well, Heath Ledger is going to be playing the Joker, and everybody just goes, you can't replace Jack. You kidding me?
Exactly.
I've since, you know, as I said, eaten my words, but I imagine it was something akin to that. Just, you know, this is a huge decision, you know, probably the only other role up to this point that had been recast, at least for a British audience, was the Doctor on Doctor Who. You know, you've got recasting, yep, of a character, you know, which was becoming fairly regular at that point.
Yes, and that might be another franchise you and I might have to dive into the deep end of the pool. Is the Doctor. That's another good one. Keep that in the back of your mind. Thanks for firing that sucker out. So Cubby and Harry needed to find a new Bond, and they this time dive out of England and go way overseas to New South Wales, Australia. And a man by the name of George Robert Lazenby. He was a model. He received a Golden Globe nomination. And he's the only Bond actor that was not European. As mentioned, he was Australian. But physically, stature-wise, he was the closest to Bond that Ian Fleming had projected. He was tall. He was thin. But almost elegant. Almost, I don't want to say feminine, but a model figure. Not like a bruising kind of guy, but very, very elegant looking. Like a model. Physically the closest to Bond in the books that Ian Fleming came up with. So there is a great documentary on Hulu about George Lazenby called Becoming Bond. Highly recommend it. So the movie they come up with, again, another Ian Fleming book, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is kind of a line you hear a lot of throughout the other movies. Dick Maybound writing again. Peter Hunt, who was a former, I think he was a set producer and other editor and such. Yeah, he was an editor. He directed this one. Dick Maybound wrote the screenplay again. In this one, now, this goes back to, I know we kind of fudged the timeline in our first episode. We're going back now to out of You Only Live Twice. So Blofeld's still a strong enemy and, of course, escaped at the end of You Only Live Twice in the little car when the volcano exploded. In the film, again, Bond faces Blofeld, who is planning to hold the world ransom by the threat of sterilizing the world's food supply through a group of brainwashed angels of death. Along the way, Bond meets, falls in love with, and eventually marries Contessa Teresa DiVincenzo. We'll get to who played her in a moment. Yes, Bond gets married in this one. And not like fake Japanese married, like he did in You Only Live Twice, but real married. When I thought of casting that they should have done for this one, again, you have a Bond that has zero experience. At least Sean had some acting experience to this point. George Lazenby had none, except commercials, shilling soap or something. Would you have thought that they wanted to at least try to add a little experience to the cast? And I feel like they sort of did and sort of didn't. Donald Pleasance does not return as Blofeld because they don't do that kind of thing. Instead, we get Kojak himself, Mr. Telly Savalas, who at this point, other than the episode of The Twilight Zone, oh, he was in Kelly's Heroes, too. So he was in Kelly's Heroes, which is a well-known war comedy movie. I think Don Rickles is in it, Clint Eastwood. And an episode of The Twilight Zone. Do we know a ton about Telly Savalas? Not really. And we really get to know him, of course, in the 70s when he is Kojak. Our woman, our Bond girl, who plays Contessa, well known to British audiences. She was, of course, Miss Emma Peel in the TV version of The Avengers with future Bond actor Patrick McNee. I am, of course, talking about Diana Rigg. I think that was a key casting choice, Tech, because I think with the unknown Bond, particularly one that's not British, having an experienced, beautiful, talented actress and not some floozy kind of thing like Ursula Andress, I think stabilized at least the casting for that movie. Or am I overthinking it?
No, I agree. She having been established, and she was an important person to cast in the movie. But she herself, like the character, I'm getting ahead of myself. Diana Rigg as Tracy is a force. This is one of the first Bond girls. Like Pussy Galore was the first one who was kind of. She wasn't the damsel in distress. As we say in our last episode regarding Goldfinger, Honor Blackman's Pussy Galore was, you know, starts out as a villain, but, you know, she's tough. She doesn't take any crap from Bond. As opposed to, say, you know, Aki, who is in You Only Live Twice. Yes, she's a Japanese intelligence operative, but, you know, she's a little wet behind the ears. Tracy is, I think, the first Bond girl who just is Bond meets his match, literally, because this is the woman he ends up marrying. And Diana Rigg is absolutely fantastic in the role. She takes no crap from him. Hell, she saves him at one point in the movie. And yeah, her being in that movie is an absolute boon to the entire film.
Absolutely. And again, I think it helps support the inexperienced Lazenby as Bond. Telly Savalas, not a bad Blofeld. I mean, he's smooth. Do they explain how Bond doesn't recognize him? Or is that like part of the in-joke that we have a new Bond and a new Blofeld and neither of them know each other?
I'm glad you brought that up, because if you weren't going to, I was going to. It's so bizarre because these are two characters who faced off at the end of the previous movie. You've got Sean Connery and Donald Pleasance literally like staring, you know, he's staring down the barrel of a gun, you know, next to the piranha pool at the end of the movie. And here you have Bond and Blofeld, now played by two different actors with obviously two different faces, and they're portrayed as if they've never met each other. Now, the real reason for this from a storytelling standpoint is because Secret Service, in terms of the book continuity, takes place before You Only Live Twice. Uh-huh. So they chose to just kind of go with the story adaptation as opposed to acknowledging their own film continuity, which is now in today's movies is a big no-no.
Absolutely.
It would more easily be the other way around today. Story be damned. Let's just make sure, you know, the movie flows. It's always been a thing, you know, and of course they try to write it off. Oh, Blofeld got some plastic surgery to, you know, remove his earlobes. Okay, well, why does he look like Kojak then, you know? but it also, absolutely, what you said before, Lazenby is definitely the closest thing to Fleming's Bond as described on the page. But yeah, that's really all I got in terms of that. You just kind of take it on faith and roll with it.
So Bond, apparently, Blofeld's trying to claim the title of Count Balthasar de Blucham. So Bond poses as London College of Arms genealogist Sir Hilary Bray, who establishes now Bond goes to meet Blofeld, although he's not sure if I guess he knows he is, but Blofeld doesn't know that's Bond, which I think is even funnier. The research institute is atop Piz Gloria in the French in the Swiss Alps. So we have our first snow Bond movie. No, not the last one. One of the reasons my mother loves this movie, because she likes all the snow Bonds. I like all the beach Bonds, I guess you call it. Meanwhile, he's pumping up these 12 gorgeous women. They're the angels of death that are going to spread this toxin over all the food in the world. His new henchman is henchwoman is Irma Bunt. that's a great name. She comes up with an important moment later in the film. When it comes to the action, I gotta say, he's not that bad. I used to, maybe it's just because of my use of, you know, knowing Sean and Roger at that time when I first started watching it. I'm like, who's this putz that did this like random standalone movie? But admittedly, he, as Bond, as I've gotten older, I've learned to appreciate more. And then considering that some crappier Bond movies have come out since, I have appreciated this one a little bit more than I originally did. Because as a movie, it's really not that bad. He's not awful in it. He's not great. But when you're following, when you're literally immediately following Sean, you know, unless you're like Laurence Olivier or something or Peter O'Toole at the time, you're not, or Charlton Heston, you're not going to outdo Sean as Bond right out of the gate. Do you have a similar thinking like me where when you were younger, you're like, eh, this is kind of, but as you've gotten older and seen crappier Bond movies, you appreciate this one more?
The short answer is yes.
All right. Longer question.
Well, let me elaborate. When I first became aware of this movie, when I first became aware of James Bond, it was because of TBS. When TBS back in the day would do 7 days of 007. That was literally how I got introduced. So there I am watching, you know, Roger Moore and Sean Connery movies, and you know, commercial breaks would come on like later tonight. And, you know, there was one for Secret Service and they're showing the preview and there's all these clips, you know, of the movie. And I'm like, I don't see James Bond. Where is James Bond? There's this guy in this movie who's talking, who kind of looks like a weird version of Sean Connery. So there I am. I don't even know how old I was. I had to be less than, you know, 12 or 11, whatever. And I didn't process. It wasn't until years later when I was going through the series, I was like, oh, all right, let's watch this one. And upon my first viewing, I didn't care for it. And it was for a very stupid reason. When there's a scene in Secret Service where he has to crack a safe. And to do that, he gets into an office and a guy outside who's working for him has to use a crane to load a giant trunk that has a safe cracking device in it up to the balcony of the office where Bond is. And he then has to hook this giant like vacuum cleaner hose up to the safe. And then it runs for like an hour to crack the safe. In the preceding movie, he cracked a safe with a gadget he had in his pocket.
Yes. Yep.
And for some stupid reason that stuck with me. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. You know, we've stepped back. So of course that's what I latched onto. It had nothing to do with the story, nothing to do with the actor, blah, blah, blah. Years later, I give it another go. I'm like, all right, I was probably too harsh on this movie. And I watched it. I really enjoy Secret Service. That's not to say it doesn't have its fault. It's very much an outlier in the entire series for multiple reasons. George Lazenby being only one of them. Yes, it's the one where he, you know, gets married at the end of the movie, but it's also right from the get-go, you can tell that this is going to be different. And I think that was done on purpose because, you know, the producers, the director, they're all like, all right, we've got a new guy. We kind of have a fresh start here, even though they were continuing the story with, you know, Blofeld and all that. Right from the get-go, you have a new gun barrel sequence. You have a new guy who drops to his knee to do mm-hmm. the turn. That right there, like, what the hell is going on? John Barry's music is using a harpsichord for the first time ever.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
The movie starts. You have an instrumental opening, which, John Barry's credit, is a fantastic piece of music. I absolutely love the theme to Secret Service. It's wonderful.
I agree.
But, you know, it's the first time since the first movie that you don't have a song being sung. You know, the song that is associated with this movie is We Have All the Time in the World, sung by Louis Armstrong, which is played during the movie, during the first act. And, you know, to just cap it all off, during your cold open, you keep this new Bond in the shadows. You don't see his face. Sure, he's driving an Aston Martin. Sure, he's got, you know, a gun in his glove compartment. And it's not until the end of this opening action sequence that he's right there. His face is lit. He's dead center in the camera. And he says, my name is Bond, James Bond. And after a few more, you know, beats of action, he practically winks at the camera and just says, well, this never happened to the other fella. So right there from the get-go, you're like, okay, we're in a completely new realm of Bond. You know, it's a new guy. It's a new feel. But it, like I said, it's definitely an outlier in the series for multiple reasons.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, the acting is, he's okay. I mean, he's trying to kind of roll with it. The problem he had was that he was getting terrible advice. First off, he was told that, well, Sean, you know, was very, you know, stuck up and just kept to himself. And that was nothing that was totally further from the truth. Maybe by "You Only Live Twice" when he was pissed off at everybody. But Dana Broccoli, Cubby's wife, says on the documentary that they were a family. They always had parties. They always ate together. If it was somebody's birthday, they'd get a cake. So during the shooting for Majesty, they were having a dinner for somebody. It was somebody's birthday or somebody was getting married or something. So the cast was – so at the end of a day of shooting, they were having a big party at the hotel they were all staying at in Portugal or whatever. And George didn't come down. And Dana came upstairs, went to his room and said, "George, where are you? We're having the party." And George goes, "Well, I was expecting someone to escort me." And the minute Dana heard that answer, she goes, "This guy's not going to work out. This isn't going to work." And apparently, Timothy Leary, you know, one of the big, you know, hippies of the day, was apparently getting in George Lazenby's ear and said, these movies are passe, you know, stuffy British, you know, misogynists who treat women like, you know, objects and, you know, all this stuffy car chase shit. No one wants to watch that crap. People want to watch Easy Rider, you know, or so he pretty much kind of fucked off during the filming of the movie. And because he didn't plan on doing another one after this. And then when he goes to the Odeon in Leicester Square for the premiere and shows up with a beard, everybody is aghast. And Cubby and Harry are like, "Fuck this, we're done." And then, of course, David Picker after the – and a movie I don't think did that bad at the box office. But that's when, as I mentioned in the documentary, David Picker came to Cubby and Harry and said, "Get Sean back." And then we get Diamonds, which probably was worse than – it was probably worse than Majesty, I guess, in many ways. But I think, unlike another Bond film that we're going to talk about momentarily that is truly gutter trash, I think this one has – I think time has healed this wound. I think watching it now – and I've watched it multiple times, both alone and I go over my mom's, and she has the old – as you know the set well – the old special edition DVD, the box sets. I gave her those when we got the Bond 50. She always likes pulling that one out to watch. That's one of her favorites. And I think time has healed that stigma of this movie being terrible. At the time, because it was the first one out of Sean, the expectations were higher than they probably needed to be. And I feel like Bond movies now, at the change of the actor, the expectations are not as high. So I don't think there's any doubt, and I'm obviously curious your thoughts, that time has healed this movie. And I mean, I wouldn't put it in the top like 10, but I wouldn't put it in the bottom 3. There's definitely of the 24 Bonds out now, there is definitely ones worse than this one. And I think time has actually maybe helped it move up the list a little.
I would agree. I have definitely gained appreciation for this movie. Like I said, my first viewing was not I didn't come out with a positive opinion, but I've definitely rewatched it over the years, you know, various times. And I really appreciate it. I think George gets a bad rap. Everybody's like, "Oh, he's the junk Bond, you know, he's the one off, you know." And, you know, there, like you said, there were plenty of reasons, you know, that he kind of, you know, bad decisions he made that got him, you know, off the project, as it were. On the whole, I really do enjoy this movie. I think Pisgloria is a fantastic location. It is definitely the first of many times we see Bond in the snow and on skis. Certainly won't be the last. I really enjoy Telly Savalas. Like you said, I think he's a very smooth, menacing villain. I think Gabriel Frizzetti's Draco is right in line with Tiger Tanaka and
yes.
Karim Bey as a Bond ally. This is another Felix Leiterless Bond, but we do have another ally. The weirdest thing about this movie, though, to me, is it starts and then you have this romantic subplot which takes up the majority of the first act.
Correct.
And, you know, you're into the movie a good chunk of time. And then suddenly it was like the writers went, oh, right, we're making a James Bond movie. We have to introduce the villain and the plot and, you know, the location and the action.
Correct.
And all of a sudden, he's at M's house. First time, first and only time we ever see M. Well, no. First time, not the last time
Bernard
we see
Lee's house.
Yes, Bernard Lee's house. Bernard correct. Lee's house. Yeah. And they're like, oh, right, we have an assignment for you, 007.
Yeah, I know.
That to me has always been the thing that strikes me. I'm like, you spend all this time, you know, because he meets Draco and he's like, I want to set you up with my daughter. She's crazy and she needs a man to rein her in, which, you know, that's a whole nother can of worms to talk about. But it's this, you know, I'm half expecting to hear raindrops keep falling on my head during half of that sequence, even though you do get that Louis Armstrong song. But it's just, you know, it's them like, oh, we're out doing, you know, coupley things. And then all of a sudden, like, right. Bond movie. Let's go. You know, let's head to Switzerland. And of course he throws on a kilt and he's now dubbed by, you know, George Baker for some bizarre reason. Like, oh, I'm impersonating this person, so I guess we should get that guy to do my voice. And, you know, he's hanging out with all of the beautiful women with food allergies who are slowly being brainwashed and, you know, now it's a Bond movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. But after that point, you know, it really hits the gas at times. Like he's there, you know, once he's exposed, you know, he's not this, you know, genealogist. Blofeld really goes at him hard. You know, he's like, all right, 007, you know, I'm not going to let you stop me, that, you know, the basic stuff. And, you know, before you know it, he's clinging to, you know, the cables of a cable car thing, you know, rig, trying to get out. You know, he's being chased, you know, down this snowy hill. He gets to this, festival or something. He's at an ice skating rink and, you know, there's all these people. And it's one of the first, it might be one of the only times you really see Bond in trouble. Like he grabs, you know, somebody's jacket or something and kind of throws it over his head and he huddles down. He's sitting and he just knows that these guys are closing in on him. You know, the editing is very, you know, kind of fast paced and everything, you know, cuts back and forth between him and these guys looking for him. And he's glancing back and forth and he's kind of pinned. His back is against the wall. He's just kind of almost resigned to, oh my God, these guys are going to find me. It's a fascinating moment where you see Bond really kind of, like I said, with his back against the wall. And at that moment, Tracy, who we haven't seen since, you know, act one, you know, with the whole romantic subplot, she skates up beautifully. And there's this fantastic pan up to Diana Rigg, and she's just looking at him, and she saves his ass. And, mm-hmm. You know, followed by a spectacular car chase that ends up in a demolition derby, of course, because why the hell not? And, you know, and then the romance is then worked back into the plot. You know, they have their moment, but then it's not over. Then it all comes full circle. He gets with Draco. He gets with, you know, Tracy's kidnapped, so he gets with Draco, and they realize we have to storm the castle. And there's this fantastic assault on the Piz Gloria clinic. And at that point, John Barry was just like, I've written this really cool theme, but for this action sequence, I think we're just going to use Monty Norman's James Bond theme. And it works so well. It's just back to the basics. It's the original piece of music. I absolutely love it. And of course that gives us the iconic shot of Bond going belly first down the ice, shooting a machine gun at Blofeld's thugs while the James Bond theme is playing. It's a fantastic climax.
Yes. And the movie's lasting image is the end, because somehow Diana Rigg pulls it off and tries to make an honest man out of Bond, and they get married. Mm-hmm. And they're driving off on their honeymoon in the DB5. I think they're in the DB5.
No, it's a different one. I forget which
different car
it is.
Yeah, I forgot what it was too. The reason I mention henchwoman Irma Bunt is because driving the other direction, they're so pissed off that the plan bombed that we get an old school mafia drive-by shooting with a machine gun. Bond is saved, but Tracy is not, and she dies. And the moment where and I gotta give George Lazenby credit, because he actually didn't do too bad in the scene when he said we had all the time in the world. And that's where the song comes from. And that's what makes Diamonds Are Forever so bad. Like, you know, here's Sean Connery walking in with his shitty leisure suit, walking up to that chick on the late, where's Blofeld? I want Blofeld. I want revenge for the killing of my wife, even though I wasn't in the movie. So yeah. I have zero emotion connected to this.
And that's what makes it so bizarre. Funny. It's one of the few instances where a Bond sequel picks up, you know, right where the other one left off. You know, where's Blofeld? Where's Blow? He punches his way through a guy with a fez, you know, a woman poolside, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. And before you know it, you know, it's Connery with his, you know, again, his purple turtleneck and his, you know, awful blazer.
Terrible. Yeah, terrible. Overall, the movie did fine. I think it made, let's see, it made, let's see. Oh, I lost it. Hold on. It made, oh, I'm looking at it right now. Adjusted to 2005, it actually made $291 million. Wow, it's pretty good. It made, at the time, and it was a long movie, it was 2 hours and 22 minutes. It made $82 million. So it did definitely dip. And then, of course, Sean came back to do Diamonds Are Forever, which didn't really help matters. And then we move ahead with the next Bond after that, which we'll talk about in the next episode. However, we're now going to talk about the guy that replaced that guy that I was about to mention. So, of course, might as well, I mean, obviously, if you're a Bond fan, you know who all the Bonds are. So after 12 years and 7 delicious Roger Moore films, which we'll get into in the next episode, Roger was in his 50s and it was time for him to walk away. So in the mid 80s, films were changing. I mean, the movie industry was very different now. We had plenty of sci-fi and plenty of Star Wars was finishing, but we had plenty of other franchises and, you know, crime, you know, we had cop movies and, you know, things were changing in cinema. So, the big problem now was just like in 1968, we need a new Bond. They thought they had a Bond lined up. He was a guy that was on the set in one of Roger's films earlier in the decade, but he got boned by television, and we will get into that story a couple of episodes from now. So in the end, they actually cast someone that was on the On Her Majesty's Secret Service set. He was 22. I think he was 22 years old. And his name, of course, is Timothy Dalton. He's a little gruffer than obviously we're used to Roger's way of doing Bond, which will, again, we'll elaborate extensively in the next week's episode. He wanted to go back to the Sean way of doing things. So when I was in grammar school, I think I was in seventh grade when I found out that, yeah, because View to a Kill came out in 85 and I was in sixth grade. So I was disappointed and sad when I found out Roger was done, but it made sense after watching View to a Kill. I don't know if I was ready for any new Bond. And I guess Sean Connery fans probably felt the same way about George. Like, I don't know what to think. Like, who's this guy? Like, I had no idea who he was. He would end up doing immensely better roles down the line, such as a Time Lord from Gallifrey. But when he was announced as the new Bond, and he did a lot of Shakespeare in his career and other things, very, very trained. I think he was the first, like, pure British. I think he was the first pure British actor.
He was not. He's Welsh.
He is Welsh.
Roger was the first British Bond.
Roger was the first British. And I think he's next to Daniel. I think him and Daniel are the only two pure British.
They are. Of the six, only two are actually British.
The two are actually British, yes. So Timothy Dalton is cast. And we have the next Bond, which came out in 1987, and it is the last Bond film for 19 years that would use an Ian Fleming title. And that movie is called The Living Daylights. John Glenn directed. John Glenn, this was like his, what, like his sixth Bond or something? We'll talk more about John Glenn in the next episode.
This was his fourth of five.
Fourth of five. He was like almost like Roger's personal director, kind of like Terrence Young was Sean's personal director. This one involves a plot about a defecting Russian general, and it's a whole big... It's kind of like... Almost like a modern version of From Russia with Love.
I would agree.
Very, very European, very espionage-ish. Among the actors that were cast, Mariam Diabo plays the cellist, and she's the Bond girl. Joe Don Baker, first time, not the last time we'll see him. Joran Crabb played Koskov. John Rhys Davies, doesn't love him. Yeah. Nobody ever said anything bad about John Rhys Davies, and no one ever should.
No.
No. This is the first Bond without Lois Maxwell. She retires. Carolyn Bliss plays Moneypenny. Robert Brown is the new M because he's kind of – Bernard Lee passed away 6 years earlier. So Robert Brown, I think this is his first one where he actually is M.
No.
Is he M in Due to a Kill?
He is M in Octopussy. That's his first movie as M.
Okay. He's the Minister of Defense, I think, in
either that or Spy Who Loved. Yeah. One of Roger's earlier movies, he shows up as a lower level British military.
M's on leave. That's what Moneypenny says to Bond in For Your Eyes Only, because during the shooting in 1980-81 is when Bernard Lee passed away. So Robert Brown is M now, and he wasn't a bad M.
No, he's fine.
Yeah, he's fine. This one, Living Daylights, goes all over the place. Pakistan. Jesus, where else do they go?
Russia.
This is Tangier. This one kind of goes all over the place. There's like Western arms dealers, very 80s centric in terms of the way the politics and the storytelling was. I was very skeptical, considering I'm a Roger guy, just like you are. I was very skeptical when I went to the movies and saw this, because I saw this one in the theater. And I walked out of the theater. I think I went with my brother, and my dad, the three of us went. And I looked at them and I said, I'll be honest, that wasn't bad. I was taken aback by Timothy Dalton's lack of humor. Look, I understand that Roger's Roger. There's only one Roger. So you can't do the wink and a nod and the cutesy stuff with anybody else. So I understood trying to go back to Sean and his way of doing it. I do feel that at times he tried too hard, almost to the point where he's kind of a dick. But this movie, I think, fit his character. It was very serious, very straightforward. We had a plot. There was no room to screw around. He didn't even have to deal with women, really. Like his charisma with ladies was like non-existent, in my opinion. But we didn't have a lot of that in this movie. So it wasn't that pressing. Having said that, though, this movie's actually not bad. It's not as bad as people on the surface look at it and go, oh, God, this is the guy that replaced Roger, huh? This movie must have sucked. No way. No way. I think Timothy Dalton's performance fit this specific film. So it was a perfect storm for him. Made a decent amount of money, $191 million, $40 million budget, so it did pretty well. And I think people were a little more forgiving of a new Bond because, yeah, that stuff happens now. What are your thoughts? Is this another one of those ones where time heals it if you didn't like it at first? Or like me, did you first watch it and go, this isn't bad, actually?
This is a movie that took me multiple viewings over multiple years to appreciate and understand. The plot is I do agree with the comparison to From Russia with Love. It is more of a straight espionage story. There's no over the top villain with a, you know, bombastic world domination plan. Right. But the plot does meander to a point where you kind of lose track of what's actually happening and who's actually you know, pulling the strings, because you start with a Russian defector. You're like, okay, cool. Bond helps this Russian guy get out of Russia. Great. And then you realize, oh, he's sticking around. You know, he's going to help MI6. Then all of a sudden he gets recaptured. And then you learn that he didn't actually defect, that he's still working with this arms dealer. Okay, cool. So he's still kind of doing some nefarious stuff. But then it turns out that the arms dealer is involved with the opium trade, which takes us to Afghanistan. And the Afghanistan has its own resistance against the arms dealers guys who are working with the Russians. And then that's where it just starts to get really, and then there's like diamonds involved, and it just takes this, it takes this bizarre turn towards the end that's almost difficult to follow.
Right.
But in the end, it all turns out that it's, you know, the arms dealer is really the guy that can pull in the strings, as I said before. I will say this about Timothy Dalton. I love Timothy Dalton. I think he's a fantastic actor. I think he's highly underrated. He's done a lot of stuff that I've really enjoyed over the years. You know, he's Flash Gordon, The Rocketeer, you know, Penny Dreadful, as you mentioned, Doctor Who. I will maintain, though, that Timothy Dalton's Bond was 19 years too early, because we got seven straight movies. And Dalton talks about this, again, going back to Everything or Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We had seven straight movies of Roger Moore's, you know, wink at the camera, tongue-in-cheek brand of humor, which is fine, is enjoyable. It's very of Roger Moore. He brought that to the role. You know, the camp was strong with Roger Moore.
Yes, it was.
So here we are with barely enough time to breathe. You know, we've got a new Bond, you know, with several, you know, casting changes and everything. And all of a sudden it's serious. You know, he's a little broader. You know, there's no winks, there's no smiles, there's not as many quips. And a lot of people, and again, this is what Dalton said in the documentary. He equated it to people taking their families to go see Living Daylights and saying, this isn't a movie I can take my children to, which is funny to think about it, that that's where the franchise had gotten to.
Right.
In Roger's time. So, but my statement about 19 years too early is when Daniel Craig, skipping ahead, when Daniel Craig comes on the scene, that's a very similar Bond, even actually more harsh and, dare I say, violent than Dalton's. But in 2006, when Casino Royale comes out with Daniel Craig, people just accepted it.
Right.
Like, this is the Bond of you know, the mid-aughts. And I think that Timothy Dalton's Bond was of that type, just almost two decades too early.
Mm, it's a great point. Excellent point. I agree with you 100%. I think the fans were not accepting of a Bond that goes back to Sean in the 60s, where you didn't take your kids to see Goldfinger and Thunderball, but you took your kids to see Moonraker.
Absolutely.
You know, and you took your kids to see Octopussy, you know, because of the gig, because of the, oh, what's the title mean? Shut up and eat your popcorn. You know, that kind of thing. So that's why I'm much more accepting of Living Daylights as a movie, because I think it fit him perfectly, even if it meant me having to wrap my head around the fact that this Bond is not as fun as my Bond. But it's still meant for a great movie.
Yes, I do. With everything I had said, I do agree with that. I do enjoy the movie. And like I said, it took me a while to understand it and appreciate it. But I do absolutely appreciate it.
Mm. So we move ahead, and everything's going great for the franchise a little bit. Behind the scenes, there is some fiscal issues. Not that anybody's broke, but more like legal fiscal issues between Cubby and United Artists, who now owns half of the franchise, as Harry sold his half. But we'll get more into that issue in the next episode, because that took place in the 70s. So Cubby's dealing with United Artists on back behind the scenes business stuff while they're shooting the next Bond. Which brings us to the first Bond titled after something not Ian Fleming written. License to Kill. Originally titled License Revoked, but they changed it because they thought Americans wouldn't know what the word revoked meant. That's like naming it. That's like changing the title of the first Potter movie because none of us dipshits know what philosophers means. But anyway, Bond goes rogue. deals with it was very of its time. And we'll talk about that a lot in the next episode with Rogers Films, because they took a lot of stuff that fit what was going on in the world at that moment. And in Roger, and in this movie, a lot of, you know, coke and tons of drugs. And it was the decade of all the drug dealing and all that kind of stuff.
The war on drugs.
Just say no. John's last one. John Glenn's last one as director. Dick Maybaum, I think this might have been Dick Maybaum's last one. Him and Michael Wilson, Cubby's son-in-law or stepson, wrote it. This movie is unwatchable. And I wouldn't say that about many Bonds. I can even find some redeeming qualities in Diamonds Are Forever. This movie is trash, top to bottom. The acting is bad. The casting is bad. The story is bad. I shouldn't say the casting is bad. Two casting choices were great. The song is garbage. Just everything about this movie felt... This to me, is almost as bad in terms of the cheapness of it as Never Say Never Again looked. To me, this was a Cinemax movie without the boobs. It just felt like cheap, low-rent action film with garbage acting, garbage women. I didn't know a lot about Talisa Soto before this movie, but she stinks. And Carrie Lowell, who would end up actually being a very good actress and spent some time, she was one of the many ADAs on Law & Order, the original Law & Order, not SVU, the regular Law & Order. She is awful in this movie. Awful. And now the seriousness of Bond that worked in Living Daylights was drudgery in this movie. And I think it weighed the movie down. The saving grace, like every crappy Bond, like every Bond movie where 80% of it's garbage, the 20% is usually the villain. Robert Davi is awesome in this movie. He's fantastic. Great bad guy. And then a very young Benicio del Toro as his henchman. Literally unknown. David Hedison returns as the first and first time, not the last, as I mentioned in the last episode, the first time that we would have a return Felix, as he was in Roger's first film. He's getting married, but Robert Davi's henchman in the movie, Franz Sanchez. Sanchez bribes the DEA agent, Ed, and escapes. Meanwhile, his henchmen ambush Leiter and his wife, Della. They take Leiter to an aquarium. The shark eats his leg, and they kill his wife. And this goes on this whole revenge thing where Bond goes rogue, which is another plot point that is so friggin' stupid. Yada, yada, yada. In the end, Bond wins. And David Hedison's cracking jokes. Ha, yay, James, yay, you win. I don't have a leg and my wife's dead, but yay, you win. I think the franchise at this point needed the 5-year break that it got, or 6-year break that it got. And we'll get more into the break when we do a future episode. But I mean, I'm sorry, Tech. There's very little redeeming about this film. Very little.
I agree. As I've said many times before, this is an 80s action movie that just happens to have James Bond in it.
Correct.
We're going to go against a drug cartel. Okay, you have fun with that.
Yeah.
You've got, like you said, I will also sing the praises of Robert Davi. I mean, he's usually great in just about anything, and he's a solid villain. He's wasted in this movie, as is, you know, people like Anthony Zerbe and Frank McRae, you know, people who are solid actors who you've seen in many other things who are just wasted in this movie. And yeah, Felix Leiter was this big monumental thing to have. Oh, David Hedison's back. Like you said, first one ever come back. Yeah. The plot point with him is just bizarre and completely unrealistic. Like you said, all this tragedy befalls him, but yeah, at the end of the movie, everything's fine. Yay. I'm calling you from my hospital bed. It's just it's the first of it's the first time Bond goes rogue, which would eventually become a trope in and of itself. He literally jumps off a balcony after essentially giving M the middle finger, like, I have to do this, bye. You know, goes off, infiltrates this drug cartel down in Isthmus, the fictional island country of Isthmus.
Yep.
And yeah, like you said, Carrie Lowell, like, not the knocker, but yeah, she's flat and just
overhead,
uninspiring. Yeah. One thing that is different about this one that is kind of amusing is it's one of the first times it's the first time we actually see Q really involved in the field. Like, we've seen him come out to meet Bond and drop off some stuff, but this time he's the only one who's really coming to help Bond, you know. And of course we get our goofy throwaway gadgets like the Polaroid camera that shoots a laser beam and takes an X-ray photo of you. Yeah. But we do get the explosive alarm clock, guaranteed never to wake up anyone who uses it.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it comes down to we've had car chases in the past. We've had some really good car chases, most of which involve, you know, cars, you know, tricked out with machine guns and rockets and all that. This movie ends with an 18-wheeler chase, which yep. in and of itself is not exciting.
No.
And to make matters worse, the effects house decided, hey, you know what would be cool? If Bond popped a wheelie in an 18-wheeler cab. Well, how do we do that? Well, we put a hydraulic in the truck that lifts up the front half. So he's not really popping a wheelie. No, but it'll look cool. Will it?
Yep. Yeah. And what else ruins, what else hurts the movie is 1989 is a killer summer for movies.
It is a landmark year.
A killer landmark year. Now, it came out July 14th. Okay, this is what came out. I'm going to pick random. These were the movies that came out in 1989. I'll just pick the ones that are, I mean, a ton came out, but here are the good ones. Starting from January. Who's Harry Crumb came out in February. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Lean on Me. Great movie. Morgan Freeman. Police Academy 6, Under Siege.
You're not even into the heavy hitters yet.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about movies that maybe Bond could beat. Fletch Lives. Troop Beverly Hills. Heathers. That's a good one. Okay, not enough fucking around. Major League. Say Anything. Kickboxer. Field of Dreams. Pet Sematary. The original, of course. Okay, we're getting into May. Okay, here we go. Now we're hitting some good stuff. May 24th, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Hell yes.
Okay, ready? This is June. June. Dead Poets Society. No Holds Barred. Yes, I know it's Hulk Hogan, but still, people were looking forward to it. Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
Eh.
That's people another were excited podcast. About it before it came out. Ghostbusters 2.
I'm waiting for the big one.
Yes. The week after Ghostbusters 2. Batman. which made money into fucking Christmas, by the way. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Do you realize Batman and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids came out the same week? Do the Right Thing. Karate Kid Part 3. Weekend at Bernie's. Lethal Weapon 2. And then the same day that License to Kill comes out, you know what it happens to come out the same day? When Harry Met Sally.
How about that?
And then later in the month, we had Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. We had a fifth Nightmare on Elm Street. We had another Halloween come out. So in past years, Bond films were able to hold their own in years where you had, you know, heavyweights up and down. License to Kill got the shit kicked out of it. Badly by Michael Keaton and Harrison Ford and Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan
and Mel Gibson and Danny Glover
yeah.
The list goes on.
it was Turner. I mean, for Christ's sakes, Turner and Hooch probably made more money. The Abyss, Uncle Buck. Oh man,
UHF.
UHF came out also. what came out in October? Halloween Fire, which is also not a great movie, but anyway, it just
yeah. 1989 was a red letter year for American summer box office cinema.
Yeah, I mean, if you go over to our to the Place to Be Wrestling Network feed, my PIC Mr. Azzaro and I, that we do the Place to Be podcast, and then we do the pop culture corners. You know, I talk about movies that came out the same weekend as some of our pay-per-views and some of our MSG shows. Batman was making movie, and I'm not even messing. Batman was making money into fucking Christmas. That's 6 months. License to Kill, I think, made money in a day. It's just
I'm fairly certain it is to date the lowest grossing James Bond movie.
I think you're right. As a matter of fact, let me see if I can, I think I can mess with the list. Here we go. Box office adjusted. Okay. Let's see. Dr. No made the lowest. Let's see. License to Kill made 156.2. This is devastating. It made more money than A View to a Kill. That bothers me, actually. But budget-wise, it was fairly expensive for that time. $36 million. It's a lot of money for a movie that terrible. By the way, Skyfall made the most, which no surprise. But we'll get to that one at the end of the series. So the movie tanked, but Timothy Dalton was set. He was under contract. Another Bond was slated to come. I'm pretty sure the next Bond was slated to come out in 1991.
Yeah, but they had kind of gotten into an every 2 years groove.
Yeah, they did. They did. Going back to Spy Who Loved Me, 77, 79, 81, 83, 85, 87, 89, every 2 years. So Timothy Dalton was completely expecting a new Bond in 1991. Well, again, as I mentioned, Cubby was having issues with United Artists and banks and all that kind of stuff. No movie on the horizon, and Timothy Dalton pretty much said, well, all right, well, I'm not waiting around. I'm done. And then we would have the Bond equivalent of Doctor Who's The Wilderness Years, because we would not see another Bond movie for 6 years. 6 years. And we will delve into the next guy in a couple of episodes from now. So there's the others. There's the other two guys, George Lazenby and Timothy Dalton, who did the other three Bonds that the big four didn't do. Hit or miss. But I do want to officially say that Living Daylights is not a bad movie. Not a bad movie. License to Kill is terrible. you and I watch it when we're in the completest mood. But a lot of times I just watch it and laugh. But I still love Robert Dobby. Just David Hedison so happy that the bad guy died when the guy's legless and wifeless. Yeah, whatever. I'm not depressed. I only have one leg and my awesome wife, which, by the way, was Priscilla Barnes, who played Terry on Three's Company, so she was hot. David Hedison got lucky there. And I'm supposed to be, you know, yay, James. Hey, James. I love David Hedison. God rest his soul. Another one that passed away in the last couple of years. Much better as Rogers Felix in his first movie, which we'll talk about in the next episode. So overall,
Tech. We didn't even talk about Wayne Newton. Wayne Newton is in License to Kill.
Wayne Newton.
As a televangelist, cult leader.
Wayne Newton looks like Kananga the way he dies. We'll get to that in the next episode. Wayne Newton. Oh, God. Wayne Newton. Oof. I think when we look back now, and the 25th Bond movie will be coming out later this year, I think both George Lazenby and Timothy Dalton will be looked at fondly. Lazenby's one movie is, I think, again, better with time. Dalton's first movie, solid for him, and his second movie we just don't talk about, and that's probably a good thing for him. Your overall thoughts on the two of them?
As we said earlier, my appreciation for the two of them in general has grown with time. Like I said, my more recent viewings of Secret Service over the years have garnered more fondness for it. I really do appreciate that movie, even though it, you know, that first act is a bit of a slog because they kind of get lost in the romance. But on the whole, I enjoy it. I enjoy George's performance. It was definitely something to get used to over time. But to this day, Diana Rigg is definitely one of my top Bond girls. She's formidable as hell. Dalton, as I said, I love Timothy Dalton as an actor. I wish he was in more. Poor guy hasn't really done a whole lot in the last couple of years. But yeah, Living Daylights, by far the superior of the two, obviously. Mm-hmm. His spy movie, his James Bond movie. I mean, hell, he even gets a tricked out car in that one.
Yep.
But yeah, License to Kill is just, it's again, I'll say it again. It's an 80s, it's just a generic 80s movie. Let's take on a drug cartel and James Bond just happens to be in it. It's,
yeah,
it's forgettable. It's barely even enjoyable. It's, yeah, yeah.
It was definitely the victim of them with their, and this was not the first time, nor will it be the last time that I feel like the producers and the director, or, you know, the Broccoli family, sadly took their eye off the ball. Obviously, Cubby was dealing with a lot of fiscal stuff, and I mentioned that. So I think the casting and the shooting of this was a little more loosey goosey than normal Bond films are.
Yeah, the James Bond franchise on the whole, and I will definitely talk about more of this in the Roger Moore episode. The franchise is very reactive.
Yep.
It tries to capitalize on what is or just was popular or hot or whatever at the time. And unfortunately, License to Kill is very much a result of that. Like, oh, well, who are the big, you know, because the Cold War was essentially over at that point, you know.
Correct.
Who are the villains now? Well, we can't really do the Russians, you know, like, well, Bond doesn't fight Nazis, you know, there wasn't really anything going on in, you know, North Korea or the Middle East at that point. So they were just kind of stuck with, you know, drug cartels. Sure, that's what people are making movies about.
Yep.
Those are the villains of the late 80s.
Oh, God. So anyway, I'm glad we got those out of the way. Thank you for listening. Follow me on Twitter at PTBPodFather. Of course, check out all the great shows on the Place to Be Wrestling Network, on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed, the Jenny Position, the No-So podcast Connection podcast feed. Tech, always a pleasure. How can people find you?
Oh, please, if you are so inclined, please follow me on Twitter at Hal Dameron. That's HALDAMERON. Or on Instagram at Technicolor. T3KNIKOLR, because, you know, why be regular when you can throw in a number and a couple of extra K's?
Exactly.
Yeah. And if you are so inclined, please check out, you know, openthefridge.net, our old nerd news site. It'll take you to our YouTube page.
Yes. And besides the fact that he sits next to me, so we have great conversations and he lets me know all the great news and notes of movie things, he always posts stuff on his Twitter and on Instagram too, so he's a good follow when you need an update on a franchise and things of that ilk, and figures and good cartoon stuff, and who knows, maybe he'll mention a great Gargoyles fun fact. You never know.
Yes, my current rewatch. Thanks,
Disney. Current rewatch. Yes, tremendously Disney Plus. So, and by the way, I did watch the Secret Origins of Justice League, and it's pretty damn awesome. These are the kind of conversations him and I have during the day when work is slow. Anyway, thank you for tuning in and joining us here on the podcast feed. We'll be back a week from now with part three of our 5-part series on the legacy of the James Bond franchise with my favorite Bond, and I'm pretty sure it's Tech's favorite Bond as well. Also has its ups and its downs, and some big time behind the scenes issues of the Bond family, but also probably some of the greatest Bond moments and Bond films of all time. We talk about The Saint. We all know who that is. He's Tech. I'm Scott. Enjoy your vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.